got down with Jane on Search for Tomorrow, because black people will be in the street looking for a brighter day.
Okay.
The revolution will not be televised.
You're listening to KPFK, and you're listening to KPFK Matters. You can check out the documents on the bylaws revision process at pacifica.org, and you can listen to rebroadcast of this program on kpfx.org. That's kpfx.org. Line one, you are on the air. Oh, apparently not. Let's try that again. Well, I must be doing something wrong. Let's try line one more time.
Clear lack of professionalism, I suppose.
Clear lack. Clearly, we're going to have to be purged and banned. Okay. Line one, you're on the air.
Yeah, I want to thank you for taking my call. I have a shocking complaint and then a question.
Okay, what's your name,
I just called in. My name is Susan. Called in to find out what happened to The Nation and Ian Masters programming, because I feel that those two shows, and I've been listening to Pacifica for a long time and a lot of stuff, are full of content and have a great diversity of people that come on with a great deal of intelligence, and they're very helpful to me. And anyway, in stating and in inquiring about what happened to why this bylaws meeting is on at this time and to register support for those two programs, a gentleman who you have answering the phone told me that he literally libeled and slandered Ian Masters and put down The Nation. He said that they're all government operatives and work for the CIA. I mean, and so that's my complaint. I think that's outrageous. And secondly, what is this, a purge with, talk about involving the listener, when you have a person who's just supposed to answer the phone start to work the propaganda that this person's point of view is, and I don't get it. I think this is completely unprofessional and wrong, and whoever this person is, maybe you should speak to them about not libeling and slandering people, and for a caller who just wants to call in and register their support of this show or that show or find out what's going on. So what are you guys up to? Is this some kind of weird purge? Are we back in a territory where there's an internal eruption that where the public is treated to hearing this stuff? Anyway, thank you for listening, but I wasn't even going to go on the air today, but I guess I've been motivated by the bizarre phone answerer.
Well, hang on just a second.
Who wouldn't give me...
Susan? Well, we're hoping to have you hang on. Maybe we can get you back up. I'm going to turn that question to Dave Adelson.
The person who's answering the phone is gesticulating rather wildly in the control room. He says that he said no such thing, so I think Ian would like to...
I think I was misquoted. She gave an opinion on those two programs. I had a different opinion, but I was simply giving an opinion.
You
I did
said,
not libel or slander
that
anyone.
Ian Masters is a member of the CIA.
When did I say that?
Operator.
No, that's a misquote.
Okay.
What kind of garbage is that? Garbage. And anyway, why are you giving your
opinion?
That's
not what I said. You're right. It's complete garbage.
Okay. Let's get to the point, ma'am. This program is not displacing permanently those programs. One of the reasons that we felt it was so important to have this show at this time was we realized that the audience for those shows are very have been at some distance to a degree from this particular struggle, and we recognize that those people are going to be voters in this process as well. In other words, you're given voting rights as well, so it's very important to include the full range of perspectives in the discussion. And because these are very popular shows, we wanted to be able to speak to this audience. The plan, as I understand it, is for the show to be aired at different times during the week so that we're sure to address all the listeners. So in no way is this a removal of those programs from the air. It's just a single day's broadcast, and you'll be hearing both shows next week.
Okay. Susan, you have anything further to say?
And watch out for libel and slander. It's not a good thing. But thank you, sir. I think I've said my piece, and thank you for taking the call.
Okay, thank you so
much. Our next caller is going to be on line three. Hello, line three. You're on the air. Who's calling, please?
Am I on now?
You are on.
I'm Harrison. I've been attending bylaws meetings because I think the bylaws are important to the future of Pacifica and to the world. I'd also just like to mention that these two slots were partially chosen because the same shows are going to appear at a different time in the near future, so it isn't as though Ian Masters or The Nation was bumped completely because both those shows are on at a different time. So
Harrison, do you have a question or a comment for our guest or
I'd like to take up the I'd like, for one thing, to mention that Margolo gave a wonderful review of our process, but she did neglect to mention one thing that we voted on, which was that in the future the bylaws would stipulate that there would be no appointed seats. And my question, actually, I'd like to discuss the membership, and I'd like to know where the other station areas are on the issue of extending legal membership to a broader group, the subscribers and volunteers. So I know that we voted to do that in Los Angeles, but what about Berkeley? And
well, Harrison, let's turn your question over to Carol Spooner of the Interim Pacific National Board. Carol?
Yes, the KPFA subcommittee is strongly in agreement. We have voted to have Pacifica be a membership organization. The members would be the subscribers and volunteers and the staff members. Our view is maybe a little different because we started from the KPFA elections model where roughly a third of our local board is elected by the KPFA staff and two-thirds is elected by the subscriber volunteer base. We like that model because it helps to improve communication and make sure that the local governing board is well informed of staff matters. So that's our proposal, and that our proposal is that the national board be elected by the local board, by the elected local board. We would like to see the national board also reflect a one-third, two-thirds mix of staff and listener members on it. And we also have been looking at the structure of Pacifica as a whole and are looking at how to interrelate the local and national organization, the local stations and the national organization, and have put forward a proposal for what we're calling an integrated Pacifica, where all of the committees of the national board would be required to have local board members on them. So, for instance, the Finance and Budget Committee would be required to have at least one local board member on that Finance and Budget Committee. Any national programming or policy committee would also be required to have local board members on it, so that we're not having a national board that's so remote and run away and not in contact with what's going on at the local stations. And we're envisioning a committee structure so that the work of both the national and the local boards would be done through committees. And at the local level, the committees would be open to participation, of the community and the staff members at the station. So that's sort of how we're envisioning things. We do want all of the listener sponsors and volunteers to have legal membership in the Pacifica Foundation. That's a core principle.
Oh, good.
Yeah, definitely a core principle.
I wonder about the indirect election of the board members. Why do you prefer that when we in L.A. are not completely in agreement on that?
I think the reason for that is we've had now 2 years' experience with our local board being elected. And the local board members, through having been elected and worked together for 2 years, have sort of formed an opinion that you can tell by working with someone where they're really coming from, as opposed to their rhetoric or their public statement. You can actually find out where people are really coming from by working with them. And so it was really the feeling of our committee, which has a lot of elected local board members on it, that the national board would be better filled by people who have served for a time as an elected member of the local board, who are familiar with the station, and who would have to know their policy views.
They would have to be members of the local board in order to be appointed to the national board.
Yes.
And so if the listeners were terribly upset, they could recall that member.
Yeah, and we're also looking at recall provisions. That's a very important matter. Under our proposal, the local boards could be recalled by those who elected them. the national board could be recalled by the local boards, or, and we're looking at an alternative measure, means of recalling national board members that would go actually to the local station members. The
so the whole board would have to be recalled at once?
What? No. No, no, not at all.
Okay.
Okay, Harrison, thank you for
your call. Any director or any local board member would be subject to recall.
Great.
Okay, Harrison, thank you so much. We're going to move along. We're going to check out Ed, it looks like, on line two. Ed, are you there?
Yeah, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Just fine. How about yourself?
Doing okay.
Great. I first became aware of the Pacifica crisis a while back when I noticed that there's kind of like a depoliticization of the station, and a lot of the more progressive and radical voices were being replaced by folks like Mark Cooper. And anyway, that's how I plugged in and found out what was going on. But these days, one of the things that I see going on is that there's a real tension, at least here at KPFK, between advocates of more Spanish language programming and English language programming. And I've been racking my brain about this, trying to figure out what possible solutions might be for this, because there's only one stream. You know, there's only one broadcast, and only so many hours in a day, only so many days in a week. And I was wondering if there's any plans to at least begin an exploratory look at eventually acquiring a sister station to do parallel broadcast in Spanish language, because ultimately I think that's the only kind of solution that that will really meet everybody's needs, because there's an English listening portion of the listenership and a Spanish listening portion, and they're going to be butting heads until there's alternatives for both.
And I'm going to turn that question over to Fernando Velasquez, who I know has been in discussion with KPFK station manager Eva Giorgio on just this topic.
Okay, thanks.
Fernando.
First of all, thank you very much for addressing this very important issue. It seems to me that if Pacifica is going to live up to its roots and principles and really go forward with searching for the roots of antagonisms and social conflict, Spanish language is not exclusive of the people of south of the border. I mean, you or anybody else can learn how to speak Spanish like we, some of us, myself included, speak English to you. It's, you know, if we meet you halfway, you know, it's rightly so expected, you know, fair to ask that you ask us halfway as well. But the other thing is that in the meantime, while we have the millions and millions of dollars that it takes to have a parallel operation, which is very expensive, why don't we learn how to share the airwaves? And by having a very intelligent folio, a programming guide, we know when the programming in Spanish or Persian or Chinese, whatever is coming up next, so we can either tune out or master that language so we can stay tuned, so we all share the medium, because after all, it's public, we all owned it, so let's learn how to share it.
Great. Yeah, I'm in favor of more truly bilingual programming where the same content is delivered in both languages. I guess I get a little bit concerned when content is delivered in one language but not in the other, though, because then either one half or the other half of the listenership is left out.
You're probably right. It will be a very happy medium overall, but I will say that, you know, the hundreds of thousands of people who produce your furniture and your clothes and get the food out of the farm, out of the fields and the countryside, for all of us here, while they learn how to speak English, we need to inform them to become better citizens, very skilled, full citizens with good, proper information, so we can all make proper, intelligent decisions before we learn the English language.
Right. Yeah, no, I think the Spanish speaking portion of our listenership is a very important group that we just plain old cannot ignore. But I guess my main concern is that we work it in a way that everybody is able to participate.
Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ed, for your thoughtful call. Next, we're going to turn to line 7 and Linda. Linda, are you there?
Thank you. Can you hear me? Because I am on cell phone.
Yes, we can hear you just fine.
Okay, great. I have 2 points, and they may enclose a question. Number one, I would like to know, and please answer after I ask my second question, if there was any particular reason that it wasn't, that the Pacifica campaign was not mentioned by name, and Juan Gonzalez, who was the leader and who took it upon himself to begin the Pacifica campaign, which, to my mind, was the political muscle behind the lawsuit, or one of the prongs that helped to push this thing, make it more public, and and to get Pacifica back to us, the listeners who love it so much. And that's my first question. And secondly, I'd like to comment that I feel that the goal of Pacifica, and just to qualify, I've been a listener since 1971, and I also was a programmer in the 70s and somewhat in the 80s, and I feel that the primary goal of Pacifica is information and a voice, which includes information in terms of analysis of what's going on, which we don't hear anywhere else. And I mean, I really have looked, and I rarely hear any of the analyses, progressive analysis, anywhere else on public airwaves. Information, but also to give voice to those communities that we have around our cities and listening areas who are working on various different issues locally and or nationally, but that who don't get voices even on their ethnic stations. And so I look at those two issues, those two purposes as the purpose of Pacifica. To that end, it's programming is vitally important in the sense that we need programmers who are not only ideologues, because ideologues do not make oftentimes the best programmers. What we need are people who are professional in terms of, well, I don't mean professional in terms of their pay, but I mean who are very skilled in broadcasters and who have an attitude that would be able to bring forth the information from guests that they have, not necessarily ideologues. And my only fear in the way the programming councils and the programming decisions may be made in the future in Pacifica is that they will tend to lean very heavily toward those organizers and activists and ideologues who may not make for good listeners and a good listening. And I also want to reiterate my support, not of the nation particularly, but of Ian Masters, who is just one of the highlights of the weekend. And with those two comments, I'd like to just listen to what you have to say.
Okay, Linda, we'll let that happen. I'm going to turn with your second question. Take that first, and we're going to turn to Lynn Gary for an answer to that. Lynn? Lynn, are you with us?
There's that
professionalism. Framing this question, I mean, I'm not sure. How are we to make sure that the program process is one that has people who use the medium of radio with skill as opposed to ideologues? Is that really the question?
Well, I think she's talking about the relationship between the role of ideology in programming at KPFK or Pacifica and the need for balance and perspective in how one approaches, and fairness, really, in how one approaches a programming.
Well, for one thing, I think the most important thing that you need to ask is that people who are on the radio, irrespective of what their ideology is, present information to the people who are listening, because anything else unless that, in my opinion, is not respect. You can't say, well, here's my opinion, and I'm telling you it, and you must adopt it. If you have an opinion and a view, something you're advocating, you ought to present background for that, justifications for that, deal with the issues surrounding that, and to deal with it intelligently, and to try, insofar as you can, as to be factual and truthful about that. And at least to me, that's what's important as a listener and for myself. Those are the values I try to bring forward as a programmer. Pacifica Radio is about not insulting the intelligence of the people listening. And that's why all of us have had our lives changed by it, and that's why all of us have fought for it. So that's my general comment. And I don't think this is a question of rules. It's not something that you can legislate. It's something that people all have to watch for, that have to constantly talk about, have to constantly critique. And one of the things that has been absent in Pacifica is some way to really engage in critique of what is on the air and address how it's following the mission and to talk about how it can be improved. And that, I think, is an important key to deal with going forward in Pacifica, as much as all of the other things that we're discussing.
Thank you, Lynn. We're going to turn to Dave Adelson for a quick follow-up on that answer.
Well, I would really like to ask a question of the caller, because what we're trying to do is establish structure so that when the listenership finds that they don't think that the programming is accurate or rigorous or to their liking, that they have some mechanism to weigh in on it. Not just the periodic appointment of rulers who make the decision, but actually in an ongoing way, some way that makes sense to be able to evaluate whether the programming's doing the job it's supposed to do. And again, that's one of the challenges. It's easy to talk about democracy. It's much harder to craft a structure in which people actually engage it, and that engagement is effective.
Okay, actually, I'm going to turn to John Markowitz now. You can only restrain the dialogue around this table for so long, and then we're going to turn right back to your calls. I promise we won't overdo this.
Yes, I was involved in the KPFK bylaws subcommittee effort. Margalo made a report on that earlier in the program. I wanted to add a couple of the other issues that our subcommittee came to some conclusions and passed some resolutions that do relate to the point you made. The bottom line, really, in regards to KPFK's control of programming, that is, decisions over programming, have to do with bylaws specifically. This is really the bottom line in terms of determining what it is that KPFK and Pacifica's content is about. It has to do with determining the authority over who sets programming content. This is an issue that is part of the bylaws of Pacifica as it is now. Essentially, Pacifica has existed in a top-down hierarchical model for many years, actually since its inception. And part of what's happening now due to the crisis that happened at Pacifica is we are in a transition period where we are seeking to democratize, that is, to bring listeners into that process of determining programming. And this is something that our committee in Los Angeles has taken a special interest in. For example, we have passed a resolution that station boards will have governing powers and that programming councils will have review, preview, and even veto or overriding power over programming decisions. So these are some of the elements that need to be discussed amongst the community on air and in the subcommittees, which we hope more listeners get involved in.
Thank you, John. With respect to your question, Linda, about the Pacifica campaign, there was no reason to leave out the Pacifica campaign. There's a lot of information I'm trying to pack into a very short time, and I guess that just happened. You're listening to KPFK. Los Angeles, and this is 90.7 FM. Our next caller will be Orlando on line 8. Orlando, are you there? Have we lost you? Orlando.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello. Yeah.
Hi.
Yeah, can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can hear you just fine.
Okay. To your first caller, to the listener, this is sounds like a tedious process, but it involves future survival of the station, and that's why we're on the air in all of this, which seems to be a little tedious. But my question is to one of the panelists with the toothache. I think he said it. I don't recall his name, but he was saying something about the Pacifica attorney had something to do with part of the problems that the station has had.
Okay.
Still an attorney. Hello?
Yes. I think we lost you for just a second. We'll turn that question over to Jeff Blankford.
The attorney was John Kriegler, and I was disturbed to find recently that he is still Pacifica's attorney. He's an attorney in Washington who handles a lot of public broadcasting clients, NPR clients as well as Pacifica, and some of the advice that he has been given, he has been giving over recent years is something that has disturbed myself and others. And to find out the other day that he is the lawyer that the new Pacifica board is consulting on its contracts is very disturbing.
Well, is there any way that the listener, a petition or whatever, or is, I mean, and that's listeners, that's why this process is going on, for reasons like that. If you
Well, this I think is something that the local advisory boards should deal with, and at the next Pacifica board meeting, which is coming up at the end of September in Houston, this should be a matter on the table. I don't think many of the people on the local advisory boards are even aware of this person, John Kriegler, and the role that he has played in the process of dismantling Pacifica.
Well, that's most definitely something that the listeners that want a democratic a station should be concerned about. And if there's a petition or something that the listeners can, I mean, what can the listeners do is to do something about that?
I would say in Los Angeles is to let the local advisory board know what your feelings are and get this issue before the board.
Okay, thank you so much, Orlando.
Thank you.
All righty. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to KPFK Matters, a Pacifica National Board mandated discussion regarding the democratization of Pacifica. We're taking your calls at 818-985-5735. That's 818-985-5735. Remember to keep your comments brief and try to focus them in just a little bit on the question of Pacifica's structure and Pacifica's bylaws. Our next caller is Brian on line 9. Brian, are you there?
I just want to express quickly the appreciation to David, Carol Spooner, and the tens of other people, hundreds, I guess, who have been involved in this effort of democratizing Pacifica, which the other thing I'd like to say is I appreciate David's comments on the information on the entire takeover and attempts to oppose it that was actually not available to us on the air. I felt that Mark Schaub, Mark Cooper, did not deal with the crisis on air, and we all know that, instead of focusing on their Mark's usual liberal wonks who come on the program. And what I'd like to know is, Carol Spooner mentioned an executive director who took over after Lynn Chadwick. I'd like to know her, I think it's her name, and I'd like to know why, as part of the legal agreement, that the people who were involved in this, in quotes, takeover, got off scot-free, and why that it continues the way. And now we hear a guy, John Kriegler, who was working for them, is now being consulted. I mean, there's something wrong with this whole situation. And I'd like to know what I'd like to know, in Carol Spooner's and David's opinion, what the underlying goal of the takeover attempt was. I mean, specifics, not vague comments. Was the bid just personal power, or was a larger underlying goal?
Obviously, we'll turn that question over to Carol. And Carol, I'm going to ask you, and Dave too, for that matter, if there's any way possible, bring that question back to the question of the bylaws. That should stretch your creativity just a bit. Carol?
Bethy Walsh was appointed executive director by Mary Frances Berry.
I can't hear her. Is there something?
Bethy Walsh was appointed executive director by Mary Frances Berry in early 2000 after Lynn Chadwick resigned. The reason the former board members got off, quote, scot-free was because it would have cost us another $1 million to pursue the lawsuits to trial. They didn't quite get off scot-free. We got an agreement to reimburse, pay damages to Pacifica in the amount of $400,000 as part of the legal settlement. It wasn't enough, but it was what we could get, and their insurance company paid it. To bring this to the bylaws, and the matter of Pacifica's counsel, I think, is a very, very important one. I think a lot of institutional memory gets lost as you have turnover on local boards. Dave and I, and I think a lot of others, need to educate our local boards and our national board about the role of Pacifica's prior attorney over the years in collaborating with the CPB and Pacifica management in some of the illegal bylaws changes, among other things. The current, I think the answer to this is we need elected boards. Right now, we don't have an elected board. We have a board that's patched together out of the legal settlement, and we need to end that as soon as possible, which is why the bylaws process is so important, and why even if we don't get perfect bylaws, I think we need to have a system in place to hold elections as soon as possible and get an elected board that is answerable and accountable to our listeners. I'm currently serving on this interim board, and I'm very frustrated, too, because I find that many of the board members really don't know enough of the history, and we need to do a better job of discussing these things on the air and preparing people for service on the national board and the local boards. So that's my quick answer.
First of all, I'd like to thank Brian for his kind comments and ask that whatever regard you have for the work that was done be repaid with work you'll do in the future. Because, again, we didn't democratize the network. We took a first step towards trying to, but it's becoming a reality is really dependent on you. The other thing is you asked why these people, quote, got off. The answer is unaccountable corporate power. It is very difficult to demonstrate that a director has not acted with the due care that a reasonable person in like position would act. I mean, Kenneth Lay at Enron and a number of these other top corporate executives are themselves getting off not just scot-free but with these incredible golden parachutes. So by comparison, what happened to Pacifica, while it's big in our world, is actually small potatoes. And this goes to the question of what this project, in my mind, was really always all about, because without changing the structure of the institutions that aggregate resources in the society, what you get is this system of accountability in which the people who make the decisions aren't accountable. I think the most important thing, bringing about the bylaws, as Raphael asked, is that there be provisions for recall and quick recall. There weren't
Absolutely.
Those things, so that when these things start to happen, you have the ability to act on them, and then it never gets to that stage.
Yeah. You also asked why were they doing this, and you wanted some specifics. I believe that it was laid out at the beginning of this program. It was a government job. That's my personal belief. I think Pacifica was far too radical in the view of certain government agents, and the CPB focused on Pacifica, brought people in who would work towards moving Pacifica into the mainstream. That was the ultimate goal. It went very far in its execution, and in the end, I think in the last year, the former board just didn't care anymore. They were saying, if we can't control it, we'll bankrupt it. So there was a real attempt to destroy Pacifica, in my view.
In my view, I think it wasn't monolithic. Many people were involved with many different degrees of understanding. While there may have been some elements of that, and I have my concerns and questions about that, certainly there were some people involved who thought they were professionalizing the network. Certainly some of the corporatists who were on the board, when we were in legal negotiations with them, were talking about how here you had a $300 million asset that was producing $12 million in income a year. And in their minds, that's a wasted resource. So they saw themselves as actually behaving in a virtuous fashion. Other people, I think, were driven by ego, seduction of power. Anytime somebody was taken, you know, removed, that meant more space or more access for somebody else. So I think there's a whole panoply of things. And Carl Gunther, a person who's active in the listener movements here in L.A., told me a quote, and I can't attribute it. But he said that in order for propaganda to be effective, the person who's receiving it must have an ulterior motive for believing it. And I think there was an awful lot of that going on. And I think to simplify it and to demonize one person or another as having the motives that maybe somebody in that whole thing did have would be a mistake, because it's going to break down the ability to communicate. But I think there was certainly a lot of malicious intent. And I think you also have to look at the Communications Act of 1996 that made all these frequencies much more valuable. These frequencies are a license to print money. And when you look at the skyrocketing prices of signals, at least some of it could very well have been the attempt to get hold of an incredibly valuable asset. There were no other licenses of comparable value for sale. And then finally, I do think that some people really believed they were going to extract this money and use it to build a more powerful network.
Thank you, David. Yeah. Thank you, Brian.
Thank you for your... I just want to comment one little thing.
Yes, quickly.
I appreciate both your very erudite comments, but therefore, it's much more important for the critique on the air, of the Pacifica Mission.
Agreed.
Couldn't agree with you more. And thank you again. We're going to turn now to another Brian. Brian in Costa Mesa. Brian, are you there?
Hello?
Hi, is this Brian in Costa Mesa?
Yes, it is. I just have three quick comments, and then I'll turn it over to another caller. First comment I'd like to make is the gentleman that's answering your phones, I thought he was completely professional, and I think that the Section 8 that, regardless if he said CIA or whatever, that's his freedom of speech and freedom of opinion. I don't think she understands that. And I'd also like to say that the democracy process that you guys are going through right now, I think it's a great thing, and I think it's going to help bring more listeners and broader support. And this isn't really on the subject that you guys are going on now, but when I was in the military, I was all over Asia. And some of the things that you guys talk about the IMF and the World Bank, I've seen their policies firsthand, and I understand what it's doing to the rest of the world. And I think it's great that you guys are bringing this kind of information back here at home where it's not really affecting us as much yet. And that's really all I have to say.
Okay, thanks so much, Brian. I appreciate it.
Bye.
We're going to turn now to line 12 and George. George, you're on KPFK.
Good morning.
Hi.
I'm a longtime subscriber. I've seen a lot of changes. I don't really understand all this local advisory board and national boards and all this stuff. That's, you know, we're working people. We can't get involved in all that. Although I'd like to, my main concern is that the previous regime put the programmers on who only wanted to talk to experts and other talking heads and never allowed callers in. This is the KCRW model, the Ruth Hirschman model of broadcasting, where you don't bring the people in because they clutter up the airwaves, they're too noisy, they're too rowdy. I think we need professional broadcasters who can bring out what the caller wants to hear and expedite the caller so that there's not a tendency for the caller to sermonize. But we really need to devote at least a third of each hour to listener calls. I think that's very important in democratizing KPFK.
George, let me ask you a question. Imagine for a moment that you had a radio station and that you were part of collectively running that radio station. What would you do with the station? What would you like to see that station serve?
Well, I'd like to see a diversity of views like we had back in the 80s when you had the Communist Party had a 15 or 20 minute show. I can't remember what it was. We had call-in shows at various parts of the day so the people, you know, who worked different hours could participate. I'd like to see programming which does encourage people to get out into the community and get involved in, you know, maybe you could have more putting forth when there's going to be a demonstration, stuff like that, you know, community calendars type stuff, not just, you know, really narrow things, but things where we're standing up to the power. In other words, you could broadcast more advertising of protests and things like that.
Okay. Well, thank you so very much. We appreciate your call.
Thanks.
We're going to turn to line one now, and line one has Peter on the other end of it, we believe. Peter, are you there?
Hello.
Hi, Peter.
Hi. Greetings to Lynn, David, Carol, Raphael, Jonathan, and Jeff.
Hi, Peter.
Thank you for doing this. All right. Caller Orlando asked, well, what can listeners do? And one of the main reasons that our KPFK signal is going up to 112,000 watts as we speak is because of concerned listeners in action. Going to meetings, answering phones, preparing food, working on the Internet or the legal avenues, all of this is incredibly vital. One of the things that our Peace and Diversity Listener Group, who's invited all of the listeners to participate in, is a Unity Fest to help build the, in the aftermath of these 7 years of purges. And it's going to be happening Saturday, July the 27th from 6 to 11 p.m. at the Armory Center for the Arts, which is at 145 North Raymond in Pasadena, California. and we're going to have live world music, dance, food. It's going to be incredible. Also, the second thing that we're trying to promote, too, is a listener forum, and I know that you're very interested and involved in that, where the listeners can put in their input, debate, and vote.
And where can the listeners reach the Free Pacifica Neighborhood Network, Peter, which I believe is what you're referring to?
Oh, okay. Two places. One phone number is 323-650-8166. And the other on the computer is UnityFest at fpnn.org.
Okay, Peter, thank you so much for your call.
Hey, thank you all.
We're going to turn now to Evan on line 3. Evan, how can we help you? Evan, are you there?
Listener, you there?
Hi, Evan. We just picked you up.
Oh, okay. I'm calling from Columbus, Ohio, where I'm an internet listener. Hi, David. I've been intensely involved in this struggle for the last several years, and it's just lately taken a toll on me, so I hadn't really planned on calling in, but the show is excellent and very compelling, and I found that even in my state, I just couldn't resist.
And we used your Matthew Lazar clip.
Oh, good, good, good. Yeah, I wasn't able to get in early enough. But one issue I want to raise, and kind of in keeping with the spirit of the discussion that is to be general rather than specific, is that I'm concerned about the Los Angeles Bylaws Committee's insistence on having that both the National Board and the local board and the Program Council all three be elected, and all three having executive powers. I've been promoting a cooperative restructuring proposal which is designed to instill a chain of accountability to the, you know, the entire structure, which steers all of the democratic authority toward the lowest common denominator, which is the membership. So I'm very glad that plans are, that everybody's pretty much in agreement that Pacifica should become a membership organization. But it troubles me that people are talking about, say, for instance, electing the program council, which is fine, but giving it executive authority in the form of veto power so that it can override the decisions of the manager, who would presumably be working at the behest of the local board, which is also a governing board. So it seems like you're prepared to set up competing governing bodies. And my non-specific concern is that those kinds of plans are motivated more by people's feeling burned by our most recent experiences with the network, and that rather than taking the time now to kind of overcompensate and democratized to the point of creating something that's cumbersome and unworkable, we all need to take a step back. I know I certainly do.
Evan, I think we get the general drift of the question. Now, I'd like to remind our callers we have a full bank of phone lines, which we've had ever since we opened up the phone. We have 15 minutes. Let's do try to keep this as sharp and to the point as we possibly can. I'm going to call on John Markowitz, and I'm going to call on Margola as well. John, first to you.
Yes, Evan, the issue of giving powers to the Programming Council that could possibly intercede or override a decision made by a general manager and the program director is really a type of power that I believe would be used rarely, and it's in the context of having an accountable process where listeners have input for such input such as in open meetings where programming and review of programming can be discussed as well as on air. I think that politically what we're talking about here is having a way of a check and balance system where instead of having only one authority to determine programming from the top, you have a way to check that power from the bottom, from the listeners. And I don't see it as competing. I see it as more of a regulating process in the sense that, for example, station board members could be, for example, removed by vote, as Dave Adelson mentioned before, in a recall. For example, if a station board had power over programming, if the listeners were not happy with any overrides those station boards made over general manager's decision, we would be able to have that type of power, that type of regulation, the checks and balance, similar, if you will, if we actually had a separation of powers in our constitutional government. Of course, that's been abused by national security directives and the like out of the executive branch, and they obviously exercise way more power than they should. But again, Margalo would also like to speak on this issue too, but I hope I addressed at least partially that concern. I do believe that politically what you have, if you have an open environment where programming decisions are reviewed by everybody in the community, then you have a more accountable type of system, even if authority is regulated from different sides of the structure. Margalo?
Part of the discussions that we've had at the meetings have to do with seeking a more cooperative working arrangement with staff, and we're still discussing that and ways of working that out. But also at yesterday's meeting, because we did discuss the possibility of having competing bodies that might be impractical, we tabled the discussion for further dates, but the discussion was whether or not this programming council should actually be part of the local governing board, which would make it probably more easy to facilitate it and not get into struggles between two bodies. So again, these are things under discussion and not final yet.
Okay. Evan, is there any follow-up question you'd like to ask?
Yeah, I'm glad to hear it's all part of an ongoing discussion, and I guess the overall concern that I had, again, was that some of our thinking is being guided by the kind of siege mentality that we were all forced, that we had all forced upon us, and that I guess trust is a basic element that needs to be established, and in some cases I think it needs to be manifested in the advance of the establishment of any particular structure in order for any particular structure to succeed. So I would encourage people to do their best to manifest that.
Okay, Evan, thank you so much.
All right.
We're going to turn to Carl on line two. Carl, how are you?
Am I on?
You are indeed.
Thanks for this.
Oh, we lost
well,
our...
Well, you
we
were.
We lost our first caller. Carl, call back in and we'll get you back up here. In short order. Next, we're going to turn to Raleigh on line 7. Then I think I'm going to skip down to Farah because we haven't heard from any women, and I'm assuming that Farah is, in fact, a woman. So let's do Raleigh first, then we'll cut to Farah and come back up to Stephen and Mark. So, Raleigh, you're on the air.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hi.
You know, my main concern is...
What the hell?
Hey,
well, we are sorry about that, Raleigh.
Well, there we go. We've lost two callers in a row. We're not quite sure what the problem is. Let's try this. Well, maybe we have him. Raleigh, do we have you here? Can you hear us? Hello, Raleigh. No, I guess we've lost Raleigh, too. So we're going to move down to line 10 with Farah. Farah, are you there?
Oh, is it me?
Yes.
Oh, hi. Basically, there's two things I wanted to say. Number one, I think you guys did an excellent job. The program has been quite educational, even for me, although I have been reading this stuff for so many years. I think you guys are doing a great job. I'm really happy. The other issue that I wanted to raise was the issue about programmers' roles, the host role, on running the show, and that's very important. One person was talking about it. I think there is a problem with people like Ion Masters because he puts a lot of his ideas, a lot of what he thinks, on the air instead of letting the guests make those comments or put their ideas. I don't think the host should get involved into a dialogue as far as putting their own ideas out. And I wanted David Adelson actually to comment on that because I know he's been studying Lou Hill and why he started the whole idea of how the host should be and how they could be actually appraised by the listeners. So I wanted him to comment on that.
David, I'd like to ask you to keep your points brief. We have about 9 minutes left and a whole bunch of
callers. I can get it done in 9 minutes. No. Well, Actually, first of all, I mean, I differ with you. I think that it's important that programmers be able to do that which they feel they need to do on mic. And I know that Ian has a very large and devoted audience, since they appreciate that. One of the things that happens is when opinions differ from our own, we notice them as opinions. When they're similar to our own, we don't. One of the things Hill was trying to get at was creating a space where programmers could have the freedom to broadcast things that mattered to them personally, that were ethically driven, that were based on ethical communication rather than the need to maintain stable audience flows. I had actually thought when you were talking about that other issue that you were going to reference the question of the relative roles of producers and programmers and what kind of freedom programmers had on the air. But I don't think we can really do that here. What I think we need to, I mean, there may be other shows like On Programming Council and On Program Policy, but I think the key thing that needs to be worked out is a process for deciding who has the privilege of being on the air that everybody feels is fair, so we don't have to hear, so that even when people are removed, they understand why and they don't feel like, oh, it was just a purge or based on a political their political beliefs. So I hope I didn't mangle your question, but that's my best job.
Okay, thank you so much. We're going to have to move on because we're quickly running out of time. We've got Carl back on line 7.
Hello.
Hi, Carl.
Hi, glad to be back. As I was saying, Lynn Jerry described earlier that there were purges to programmers during the Healthy Station project, and that has actually redefined our audience at many of the stations. KPFT has been, until we took back the stations, broadcasting a country music format primarily. WPFW has been doing jazz. And those listeners, there's no guarantee that the listeners at those stations have any serious connection to Pacifica's mission. And since Pacifica's reason for existing is its mission, it's quite problematic, although I support elections, it's quite problematic to ensure that the audiences of Pacifica, as currently constituted, will vote in a way that's consistent with Pacifica's mission. And it's essential that if we are to hold elections, that Pacifica's mission not be undermined by voters who don't support that mission. So there are really four ways to address that problem. We can attempt to restrict the voters to people who support Pacifica's mission somehow. We can attempt to restrict candidates to people who support Pacifica's mission. We can run an energetic registration and get out the vote campaign among voters likely to support our mission so that any voters who do not support it will be overwhelmed by those who do. And finally, we can set up some checks and balances so that if an election outcome threatens the mission, that outcome can be modified or invalidated by another Pacifica entity. Now, that is the approach, I think, the last one I've heard Carol Spooner mention. The KPFA model for voter and candidate qualification upon which the election bylaws changes regarding elections is baselined by the legal settlement that was signed is so open to candidates and to voters that it provides almost no confidence that voters and candidates will be supportive of Pacifica's mission. Now, that model worked fairly well in 2000 and 2001 when the KPFA lab was elected, but they had no real power over the operation of the station or the network at that time. In the new situation that we're now in, there's a likelihood that the labs will have a direct say in the operation of the station and will also play a role in selecting the Pacifica National Board. And so some candidates and voters may attempt to qualify as voters solely in order to take over Pacifica's valuable resources for purposes other than its mission.
Okay.
I'd like to hear Carol Spooner in particular address that question, and thank you very much.
Okay, I'm going to turn that over to Carol, and then we're going to come back, and Fernando wants to like to make a remark. We're going to have to keep it very, very brief. We've got about 2 minutes before we've got to put it into the phone calls. Carol, a quick response. Carol, are you there?
That was quick.
Fernando.
Well, I'm going to be a lot quicker than Carol. One way to address this is to reverse the Healthy Station Project influence that we still have on KPFK, have some real progressive programming, have programs that address the marginalized, neglected communities, to bring a new audience that really cares about the Pacifica mission, that really cares about having a progressive family for change in this country. And then we have elections with these new listeners, with these new people, and then we will have something else, sir. Thank you.
Okay, I want to thank you so much, all of you, for calling in. I want to thank David Adelson, Fernando Velasquez, John Markowitz, Margaret,
Ashley Ferrand.
Ashley Ferrand, thank you. Carol Spooner.
Bye, Lynn.
Jeffrey Blankford, Lynn Gary, and Ian Masters and the whole crew. To find out how
Thank you, Raphael.
thank you, Dave. To find out how you can become involved in the regular meetings of the KPFK Bylaw Subcommittee, please call the station during business hours Monday through Friday at 818-985-2711. That's 818-985-2711. Or log on to www.kpfk.org for the meeting schedule. Also, you can hear a rebroadcast of this program on kpfx.org two times a day. Fernando is insisting that I'm aware that this is every day. We also want to thank Lorraine Mirsa very much and remind you that you can also check those locations to find out the next scheduled time and day for the next KPFK Matters program. This is Rafael Renteria for the production team of KPFK Matters. That includes... Bernie Eisenberg, David Adelson, Margalo Ashley Ferrand, Paul Lyon, Lorraine Mirsa, myself, Fernando Velasquez, as I may have said, John Markowitz, as I may have said. Anyway, we were all elected by the KPFK Bylaws Subcommittee to do this program, and you can see why. Again, for the production team of KPFK Matters, the KPFK Bylaws Subcommittee, for KPFK Management, thank you all very much for participating.
Thank you, Ian, for letting us use your show here.
This is KPFK Los Angeles, 90.7 FM. The next KPFK Local Advisory Board meeting is Saturday, July the 20th at 2 p.m. at the Mercado La Paloma Conference Room. That's 3655 South Grand Avenue in Los Angeles. For further details, check out kpfk.org. KPFK's Reporters Roundtable, Deadline LA, with Barbara Osborne is next with a look at secret biochemical tests conducted on U.S. Navy personnel.
Hi, I'm Simeon Pillich. This summer, the Skirball Cultural Center and KPFK invite you to join them in July and August for a free concert under the stars each Thursday at 7:30 p.m. On July 18th, Ricardo Lembo and Makina Loca will bring us their infectious blend of Congolese rumba and the tradition of some of the great orchestras of the Congo and Cuba. Don't miss the buoyant Afro-Salsa of Ricardo Lembo and Makina Loca on Thursday, July 18th at 7:30 p.m. Come early for sunset, food, and the concert is free. For more information, visit skirball.org or call 310-440-4500. This concert is sponsored in part by KPFK 90.7 FM. Querido amigo, te lo suplico. Mi tambor
es mi religión. KPFK 90.7 presents Our Music is Our Weapon, a benefit to equip KPFK DJs with the tools they'll need on the ones and twos. Featuring Rocka Ira Science of Dilated Peoples, the legendary DJ Mark Love of Unity and the Zulu Nation, Jared Quickly, Slam Poet Peace, Divine Forces Radio Resident DJs, and very special guests. Join us Wednesday, July 17th at the Temple Bar, 1026 Wilshire Boulevard in Santa Monica. Doors open at 8 p.m. Music begins at 9 p.m. and goes till 2 a.m. $7 at the door, or for pre-sale tickets and information, call 310-393-6611. That's 310-393-6611, or go to templebarlive.com. This show is 21 and 0. Presented by Todos Sonidos Presenta, DFR, and KPFK 90.7 FM.
As basic as the roof over your head, as basic as food, this essential is new.
Remember Agent Orange and Gulf War Syndrome?
In both cases, the U.S. military subject its own troops to really dangerous chemical concoctions. Astonishingly, a new instance of this kind of behavior has come to light. Welcome to Deadline LA. I'm Barbara Osborne. The story hasn't gotten much play in local media, but it's getting a great deal of attention in Washington. The story was broken by a Los Angeles producer who joins me today. In fact, the story first came to light 2 years ago when freelance investigative TV producer Eric Longobardi did a series for CBS about tests in the 1960s involving U.S. Navy ships that were sprayed with a variety of chemicals for testing purposes. And as happens with a surprising number of explosive stories, reaction takes a long time to gather steam. The reaction to Eric's story is only now bearing fruit. Just this week, the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee held hearings on the tests, and the Pentagon's glacial response to requests for information about them. Eric Longobardi is an award-winning LA-based investigative TV producer. He joins me today. I'm delighted to have him here. Eric, thanks very much for being here.
Good morning.
Can we start with how you first stumbled upon this story years ago?
I actually was working in New York in a particular news program, and I got a call from a guy out of the blue who wasn't actually the person who specifically knew about this. He was a relative of that person telling what sounded to me like somewhat of an X-Files story, which was his brother, had been in the Navy, and he's always thought that this one year back in 1963 when he was out in Hawaii, there was some weird things that went on when he was on board his ship, and he had always tried to find out what was going on, and he never could. For years, he had inquired about it to the VA and in writing letters to his congressman and the Department of Defense and anybody he could think of, and basically he got absolutely no response and told he was what he was talking about was really just a pipe dream. And he started giving me some of the facts about who he was, where he was, what ship he was on, and from that point, I just took it from there, and his story sounded pretty wild, actually, but he had enough specific facts about what he had seen and where he was, and you know he could prove what ship he was on and all that sort of stuff, and I just took it from there and started to piece together a puzzle of what the story in generic he was telling me, and it turned out to be basically true what he was telling me. He had seen some things when he was on board his ship of guys with weird devices and particularly a guy in a full chemical warfare suit, which obviously might get your attention.
I mean, it does sound like
X-Files. Yeah, I mean, even in 1963, in a yeoman, sailor, when you see something like that, it caught their attention, and he said no one would ever say what they were doing at the time, and it stuck with him for many, many years.
So let's lay out what we know about these tests at the moment. Do we know how many tests there were, how many sailors were affected, what they were exposed to?
Yeah, we do. Not fully. We haven't got to the complete full picture yet, but the basic outlines and a lot of the details have been exposed, and that is that during the 1960s, there was a very large program called Project Shad, which was part of a bigger program of biological and chemical testing. In Project Shad, basically, in layman's terms, what they did was use Navy ships and other sorts of ships in biological and chemical spraying tests. For the idea of the program was to test the vulnerability of ships to attack. The real secrets of the program are that it wasn't just to test the vulnerability of a ship and learn how to penetrate and protect a ship from these sorts of compounds. It was a key component, and the component that is still being covered up today is the human test subject aspect. That was a key component of the program that to date, and is why it's taken 40-some years to start to get some of the secrets revealed about this program. That's a very sensitive issue in terms of the government and the Pentagon acknowledging that U.S. servicemen were used as guinea pigs in these sorts of tests. And that's something that's still, it's starting to come to light in its full spectrum, but it hasn't completely yet. And
Eric, do we know how many servicemen were on those boats, or how many tests were conducted?
Yeah, basically the Project Shad itself was part of an umbrella program, but Project Shad had approximately, the number that's been bandied around is 113 or so tests. The number of sailors involved is most likely going to end up being in the tens of thousands. To date, the VA has positively identified in relation to 12 tests about 4,000 or 5,000 guys that they're supposed to be notifying of their participation. Only 600 or so of those have been notified to date, 2.5 years after they began their official investigation, after my stories were broadcast in 2000.
So what the VA has done is taken the 12 tests that the Navy is willing to acknowledge, the Department of Defense is willing to acknowledge at this point. They found out who were on those 12 ships, and they've notified those guys.
Right. What has happened, actually, in this case, the VA is, to be real generic about it, the VA has been somewhat of the good guy. The VA, in past years, there was less than a handful, a few guys who had inquired, like this guy that I originally got in contact back in 1994, and each and every one of them, there are very few of them, had gotten the same answer, which was, you're crazy and this never happened. After the Pentagon initiated its investigation in late 2000, the VA has none of this information. The majority of this information is still classified and has been since the day it was created and these tests were done back in the 60s. So the DOD has been, and particularly the U.S. Army who operated these tests, have basically been the holder of the secrets, and they haven't been telling anybody, including the VA. So the VA got the answer back that we can't verify what you're attempting to tell us about because the Army said, you know, they have no information on it. And when they said that, they were lying. And they do have a lot of information on it, but it's all highly classified. And over the years, very little of it has come out until, you know, recently.
And what about the stuff that these sailors were sprayed with? What do we know about what that stuff was?
What was really interesting about this program, and part of what the Pentagon has done and tried to keep it covered up, is it was divided into two parts. There was a what I call the Shad unit. It was a small little fleet of ships operated by the Army. It was the Army's secret little Navy, if you like. It was a 5 tugboats and 2 laboratory ships called YAGs. They're basically lab boats. They operated in the Pacific, and they did testing in which, in layman's terms, they sprayed themselves, usually, or other things like barges full of monkeys and things like that. And they used some of the most lethal chemical and biological warfare agents, weapons that, you know, are known to man. But those particular individuals were somewhat aware of what they were doing because that was their job as a secret little unit. A couple hundred men at most participated in that cadre that did those tests. The majority of the program throughout those years involved another aspect of Shad, which was the use of what the Pentagon likes to term something called a simulant. It's kind of an Orwellian doublespeak term. Something called BG was the most prevalent one used. It's scientifically, it's a stand-in for anthrax. It's a living bacteria, just like anthrax is, but it's not as directly lethal as anthrax, but it is, the military has claimed these simulants were harmless. It turns out they're not. Many of the other ones they've used throughout those years have gone from harmless to harmful over the years as science has progressed and determined that, well, that wasn't exactly harmless, so we stopped using it. The majority of the tests used this BG to spray shiploads, you know, of Navy sailors on board regular, what they call Navy, regular Navy fleet ships that were just brought in unbeknownst to these crews and unbeknownst to these men and used as targets and sprayed with these clouds of biological and chemical compounds. Most of these men, and nearly all of them even to date, are unaware that they ever participated in these tests because they thought they were just tooling around in the ocean doing their normal drills, while in fact, you know, planes were spraying clouds of bacteria and chemical compounds. Their ships would sail through them, and you can't see that sort of stuff unless you happen to see the plane, you know, 10 miles up from your ship or have, you know, knowledge of what's going on. And because this was so highly classified and compartmentalized, none of this information ever got even close to the recipients of what was going on.
Do we know whether those guys got sick?
Many of the compounds have some pretty serious medical relationships to them. Because of the fact, the men who operated this little cadre unit, some of them have been complaining of getting sick, and there have been some studies done that show that these men have gotten sick at a higher rate than other people in the military because they were obviously exposed to very dangerous compounds. If they got any of it, the likelihood of having some kind of medical problem was greater. The other men, for example, because of the fact
these are the guys without who did not give informed consent.
Right. Nearly all of the people involved in this program had no informed consent. It was highly classified. Very few did, but the vast majority didn't. Most of them have been for 40 years completely unaware of their participation. Many of them have all kinds of health problems and things that, until recent disclosures on this, they had no idea they participated. So, yeah, there are, and scientifically, the compounds which were used have been come to known to be very dangerous. Things like BG itself, this bacterium that's the stand-in for anthrax, is not harmless as the military claims. Some of their own scientists later on, as science progressed in the late 80s, described that for themselves. The Army hasn't made any of that stuff public because BG is still used today. They've attempted to spray it in open air sprayings in public about 2 years ago out in Los Alamos. They tried to do a spraying where they neglected to tell anybody in the neighborhood that they were going to do this, and when it was found out, the test was canceled and BG was what they were going to use. BG is basically the only thing they have left in terms of something they can use to simulate a lethal agent. And even though it's not directly lethal, when they spray it on you like anthrax is, it can get you later on, and it can get you in different ways. And exposing someone to that sort of compound without their informed consent is something that most Americans would think is not the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you about VX and sarin gas as well. Before I do that, let me just remind people that you're listening to Deadline LA on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles County, 98.7 in Santa Barbara County. I'm Barbara Osborne, and I'm talking today with Eric Longobardi. He's an award-winning Los Angeles-based investigative TV producer. He broke a story 2 years ago, did a series for CBS about secret tests by the U.S. military in the 1960s involving various kinds of chemical concoctions, I gather, including VX and sarin gas, Eric?
Correct, in some of the tests. Both chemical and biological. The biological agents, I'd have to say, are probably the more dangerous of the two. The chemicals also, but in addition to these tests, one of the other aspects is not just what they sprayed on the men in the ships. Other sorts of compounds, like they used to decontaminate the ships at the time, were just thought to be okay. It turns out some of those are probably carcinogenic or worse. So it's basically these men were hit with various chemical, biological, and other compounds that every which way but loose, they've been exposed to things that the military and the Pentagon have not wanted to tell them about for a long time.
So you first broke the story 2 years ago. How'd the Pentagon respond then?
The Pentagon initially, what the Pentagon story has been, they finally did admit that these tests actually occurred.
They admitted that as a result of the CBS.
Yeah, they admitted, and to be very honest, the generic version of these tests had been known for many years.
What's the generic version?
The generic version is that the U.S. Defense Department, the U.S. military had elaborate, extensive, gigantic, it's probably the trigger, secret biological and chemical testing program, which encompassed basically everything under the sun. And I like to stick to layman's terms. I basically have a term that I use is, you name it, they sprayed it. It just depends on when and where and what. They sprayed American cities with BG over the years. They dropped light bulbs of BG in the New York subway system. The program was massive. It had various aspects. And Project Shad is just a very... a very secret little, actually very big, but of a much larger program that had never had any exposure on it. And the reason why, in my opinion, is that there's this aspect of human subject testing. In the previous sorts of tests that occurred over the continental United States, they had sprayed things over cities, but the military has always claimed that, well, we thought these things were harmless when we sprayed them, therefore we may be sorry for what we did, but the stuff was harmless, so why should anybody care? There's no problem. What they've always denied is that when they did these tests, as the bug scientists like to say, as a part of the protocol in what made Project Shad very newsworthy, was as a part of the protocol of the actual testing when they were conducted, human subjects were a part of the protocol. They specifically wanted men on those ships because even though they had mechanical devices to learn and understand how chemicals and biologicals penetrate and disseminate and all these terms they use in terms of what these tests were designed to do, they also wanted human beings on those ships, or they could have had empty ships or barges. They wanted human beings so they could understand how this stuff penetrated and disseminated into their lungs and into their body. And in Project Shad in particular, in many of these tests, they actually took gargle samples and throat swabs from men on board the ships who had no idea what they're doing. They're just Navy crewmen ordered to blow in a tube or, you know, cough up a gargle sample. And it doesn't take a microbiologist to know that when somebody takes a bodily sample from you, that there's some sort of purpose in doing that in terms of understanding what's getting inside you. And that was a very important part of this program, and that's the part that the Pentagon most wants to keep under wraps, and that's they're still trying hard to do that.
Let me ask you about the footage of the test that you managed to put your hands on. I guess I'm this is a two-part question. One is, how'd you put your mitts on the footage? And two, what on earth do you see? I gather if I only had Real Player on my computer, I could still see this footage if I went on to CBS.com?
Yeah, you can actually still see the stories as broadcast in 2000 on CBS's webpage. The footage that I was able to obtain, the kind of the smoking gun material that... described what exactly happened in these tests was and still is almost completely classified. Very limited portions of that material were gotten out by me under the Freedom of Information Act and executive order, which requires the declassification of stuff that's 25 years or older. But that very limited portion was able to describe what in fact took place. But the footage, for example, in these test reports and test plans, there was descriptions of footage. I specialize in military reporting, and the one thing you know about the military is they document everything they do. Whether or not they can keep track of it or find it or locate it is another question. But when they do what they do, they fully document, and, you know, better than anybody you can imagine. And in one of the test reports, it described there was an annex which described the filming that was required to be done for this particular test called Autumn Gold, which is coming to be known as probably the most famous test that involved this program, not just from the outside, but from the inside. This was the biggest, largest scale test that was conducted in the program in its entirety, I believe, and when it was done. Every other test in the program is somehow related to this test. They compare it, which is the scientists compare its results and all sorts of things. This footage was described, and it's one thing to see it on a piece of paper, that it was actually shot and put on film. It's another thing 40 years later to try to find it. Through many years of searching, through FOIA requests and all kinds of other investigative reporting, I was unable to locate it officially or unofficially. But finally, I found a source that I won't tell you where, but at a very intricate location as part of the biochem testing program that continues to this day, who basically went and looked in a place that he knew this sort of stuff may be, wherever that is, someplace on a military base, I can tell you that, and found a can of film, an unlabeled can of film on the floor of a closet, 16 millimeter film, and put it on a projector. He told me this all after the fact. Put it on the projector, turned it on, and the first thing that came up was a title card that said Autumn Gold. And then he proceeded to watch some 40 minutes of raw 16 millimeter footage of the ship's every aspect of what took place in that test. And then as a little bonus, which I didn't expect, and didn't expect to find the film, to tell you the truth, but as a little bonus, he said there's another thing on the end of the film. It's another test called Copperhead, but this one's actually is edited, scripted, and has music and a presenter. And I said, wow,
ready for Ed Sullivan.
Yeah, it was ready for